A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. Epiphany at Dollymount Strand. The phrase and the day and the scene harmonized in accord. Words. Was it their colors? He allowed them to glow and fade, hue after hue. Sunrise gold, the russet and green of the apple orchards, azure of waves, and the grey fringed fleece of the clouds. No, it was not their colours, it was the poise and balance of the period itself. Did he then love the rhythmic rise and fall of the words better than their associations of legend and colour? Or was it that, being as weak of sight as he was shy of mind, he drew less pleasure from the reflection of the glowing, sensible world through the prism of a language many-coloured and richly storied than from the contemplation of an inner world of individual emotions mirrored perfectly in a lucid, supple, periodic prose? He passed from the trembling bridge onto firm land again. At that instant, as it seemed to him, the air was chilled and, looking askance towards the water, he saw a flying squall darkening and crisping suddenly the tide. A faint click at his heart, a faint throb in his throat, told him once more of how his flesh dreaded the cold, infrahuman odour of the sea. Yet he did not strike across the downs on his left, but held straight on along the spine of rocks that pointed against the river's mouth. A veiled sunlight lit up faintly the grey sheet of water where the river was embayed. In the distance, along the course of the slow-flowing Liffey, slender masts flecked the sky, and, more distant still, the dim fabric of the city lay prone in a haze, like a scene on some vague arras, old as man's weariness. The image of the seventh city of Christendom was visible to him across the timeless air, no older nor more weary nor less patient of subjection than in the days of the Thingmoat. Disheartened, he raised his eyes towards the slow drifting clouds, dappled and seaborne. They were voyaging across the deserts of the sky, a host of nomads on the march, voyaging high over Ireland, westward bound. The Europe they had come from lay out there, beyond the Irish Sea, Europe of strange tongues and valleyed and wood-begirt and citadelled and entrenched and marshalled races. He heard a confused music within him as of memories and names, which he was almost conscious of but could not recapture even for an instant. Then the music seemed to recede, to recede, to recede. And from each receding trail of nebulous music, there fell always one long drawn calling note, piercing like a star the dusk of silence. Again, 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 a voice from beyond the world was calling, "Hello, Stephanus." Here comes the Daedalus. Oh, give it over, Dwyer, I'm telling you, or I'll give you a stuff and the kisser for yourself. Oh, good man, Towser, duck him. Come along, Daedalus, bow stiff and amenos, bow stiff and amenos. Duck him, guzzle him now, Towser. Help, help, oh! He recognized their speech collectively before he distinguished their faces. The mere sight of that medley of wet nakedness chilled him to the bone. Their bodies, corpse white, or suffused with a pallid, golden light, aurorally tanned by the sun, gleamed with the wet of the sea. Their diving stone poised on its rude supports and rocking under their plunges, and the rough-hewn stones of the sloping breakwater over which they were scrambled in their horseplay gleamed with a cold, wet luster. The towels with which they smacked their bodies were heavy with cold seawater, and drenched with a cold brine was their matted hair. He stood still in deference to their calls and parried their banter with easy words. How characterless they looked, Shuly without his deep unbuttoned collar, Ennis without his scarlet belt with a snaky clasp, and Connolly without his Norfolk coat with the flapless side pockets. It was a pain to see them, and a sword-like pain to see the signs of adolescence that made repellent their pitiable nakedness. Perhaps they had taken refuge in number and noise from the secret dread in their souls. But he, apart from them, and in silence, remembered in what dread he stood of the mystery of his own body. Stephanos Daedalus, bau Stephanamenos, bau Stephanameforos. Their banter was not new to him, and now it flattered his mild, proud sovereignty. Now, as never before, his strange name seemed to him a prophecy. So timeless seemed the grey, warm air, so fluid and impersonal his own mood, that all ages were as one to him. A moment before the ghost of the ancient kingdom of the Danes, he looked forth through the vesture of the haze-wrapped city. Now, at the name of the fabulous artificer, he seemed to hear the noise of dim waves, and to see a winged form flying above the waves and slowly climbing the air. What did it mean? Was it a quaint device opening a page of some medieval book of prophecies and symbols? A hawk-like man flying sunward above the sea? A prophecy of the end he had been born into to serve. And had been following through the mists of childhood and boyhood, a symbol of the artist forging anew in his workshop out of the sluggish matter of the earth, a new, soaring, impalpable, imperishable being. His heart trembled, his breath became faster, and a wild spirit passed over his limbs, as though he was soaring sunward. His heart trembled into an ecstasy of fear, and his soul was in flight. His soul was soaring in an air beyond the world, and the body he knew was purified in a breath, and delivered of incertitude, and made radiant and commingled with the element of the spirit. An ecstasy of flight made radiant his eyes, and wild his breath, and tremulous and wild and radiant his windswept limbs. 1, 2, look out! O cripes, I am drowned! 1, 2, 3, and away! The next! The next! 1, uck! Stephanophorus! His throat ached with a desire to cry aloud, and the cry of a hawk or eagle on high to cry piercingly of his deliverance to the winds. This was the call of life to his soul, and not the dull, gross voice of the world of duties and despair, not the inhuman voice that had called him to the pale service of the altar. An instant of wild flight had delivered him, and the cry of triumph with his lips withheld cleft his brain. Stephanopheros! What were they now but the cerements shaken from a body of death, the fear that walked into night and day, the incertitude that had ringed him round, the shame that had abased him within and without, cerements and lineaments of the grave. His soul had risen from the grave of boyhood, spurning her grave clothes. Yes, yes, yes! He would create proudly out of the freedom the power of his soul, as the great artificer whose name he bore, a living thing, new and soaring and beautiful, impalpable, imperishable. He started up nervously from the stone block, for he could no longer quench the flame of his blood. He felt his cheeks aflame and throbbing throat with song. There was a lust of wandering in his feet that burned to set out for the ends of the earth. On, on, his heart seemed to cry. Evening would deepen above the sea, night fall upon the plains, dawn glimmer before the wanderer and show him strange fields and hills and faces. Where? He looked northward towards Hoth. The sea had fallen. Below the line of sea wrack on the shallow side of the breakwater, and already the tide was running out fast along the foreshore. Already one long oval bank of sand lay warm and dry amid the wavelets. Here and there, warm isles of sand gleamed above the shallow tide, and about the isles, around the long bank, and amid the shallow currents of the beach, where light-clad figures, waving and delving. In a few moments he was barefoot, his stockings folded in his pockets, and his canvas shoes dangling by their knotted laces over his shoulders, and picking a pointed salt-eaten stick out of the jetsam among the rocks, he clambered down the slope of the breakwater. There was a long rivulet as he waded up its course. He wondered at the endless drift of the seaweed, emerald and black and russet and olive. It moved beneath the current, swaying and turning. The line of the rivulet was dark with the endless drift and mirrored the high drifting clouds. The clouds were drifting above him silently and silently, the sea tangle drifting below him, and the grey warm air was still, and a new wild life was singing in his veins. Where was his boyhood now? Where was the soul that had been hung back from her destiny to brood alone upon the shame of her wounds, and in the house of squalor and subterfuge to queen it in faded cerements and in wreaths that withered at the touch? Or where was he? He was alone. He was unheeded, happy, and near to the wild heart of life. He was alone, and young, and willful, and wild-hearted, alone amid a waste of wild air and brackish waters, and the sea harvest of shells, and tangle, and veiled grey sunlight, and gay-clad, light-clad figures of children, and girls, and voices childish and girlish in the air. A girl stood before him in midstream, alone and still, gazing out to sea. She seemed like one whom magic had changed into the likeness of a strange and beautiful seabird. Her long, slender, bare legs were delicate as a crane's, and pure, save where an emerald trail of seaweed had fashioned itself as a sign upon the flesh. The thighs, fuller and soft-hued as ivory, were bared almost to the hips, where the white fringes of her drawers were like feathering of soft white down. Her slate-blue skirts were kilted boldly about her waist and dovetailed behind her. Her bosom was as a bird's, soft and slight, slight and soft as the breast of some dark plumaged dove, but her long, fair hair was girlish and girlish, and touched with the wonder of mortal beauty her face. She was alone and still, gazing out to sea. And when she felt his presence and the worship of his eyes, her eyes turned to him in quiet sufferance of his gaze. Without shame or wantonness, long, long, she suffered his gaze, then quietly withdrew her eyes from his and bent them towards the stream, gently stirring the water with her foot hither and thither. The first faint noise of gently moving water broke the silence, low and faint and whispering, faint as the bells of sleep, hither and thither, hither and thither. A faint flame trembled on her cheek. "Heavenly God!" cried Stephen's soul in an outburst of profane joy. He turned away from her suddenly and set off across the strand. His cheeks were aflame, his body was aglow, his limbs were trembling. On and on and on and on he strode, far out over the sands, singing wildly to the sea, crying to greet the advent of the life that he had cried to him. Her image passed into his soul for ever, and no word had broken the holy silence of his ecstasy. Her eyes had called to him, and his soul had leaped at the call to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, to recreate life out of life. A wild angel had appeared to him, an angel of mortal youth and beauty, an envoy from the fair courts of life, to throw open before him in an instant of ecstasy the gates of all the ways of error and glory. On and on and on and on. He halted suddenly and heard his heart in the silence. How far had he walked? What hour was it? There was no human figure near him, nor any sound borne to him over the air, but the tide was near the turn, and already the day was on the wane. He turned landward and ran towards the shore, and running up the sloping beach, reckless of the sharp shingle, found a sandy nook amid a ring of tufted sand knolls, and lay down there that peace and silence of the evening might still the riot of his blood. He felt above him the vast indifferent dome and the calm processes of heavenly bodies, and the earth beneath him, the earth that had borne him and had taken him to her breast. He closed his eyes in the languor of sleep. His eyelids trembled as if he felt the vast cyclic movement of the earth, and her watchers trembled as if they felt the strange light of some new world. His soul was swooning into some new world, fantastic, dim, uncertain as under the sea, traversed by cloudy shapes and beings. A world a glimmer or a flower, glimmering and trembling, trembling and unfolding, a breaking light, an opening flower. It spread in endless succession to itself, breaking in full crimson and unfolding and fading to the palest rose, leaf by leaf, and wave of light by wave of light, flooding all the heavens with its soft flushes, every flush deeper than the other. Evening had fallen when he woke, and the sand and arid grasses of his dry bed glowed no longer. He rose slowly and, recalling the rapture of his sleep, sighed at its joy. He climbed to the crest of the sandhill and gazed about him. Evening had fallen. A rim of the young moon cleft the pale waste of skyline, the rim of a silver hoop embedded in grey sand, and the tide was flowing in fast to the land, with a low whisper of her waves, islanding a few last figures in distant pools.